a washboard potential out of a simple, all we needed to do was to current bias to Joseph's injunction, and out of that immediately we would obtain a washboard potential. And now what we want to do is to understand the bound states in that washboard potential. And it would be really easy to calculate analytically, it is really easy to calculate analytically, the bound states in a cosine potential. But it's not easy to calculate them analytically in a tilted cosine potential. And so we'll take an excursion for a few minutes and either remind you or teach you about finite difference methods of approximating the Schrodinger equation so that we can get a simple approximation to this, look at the numerics, and see. So basically what we're going to do is use the finite difference method. Which has the nice piece that it's the simplest, most straightforward thing you could imagine doing. And for at least the low energy states, it'll give you a good approximation to the correct answer. And since we're only looking at bound states, we only care about those anyways. So let's have a look at this. So basically what we want to do is we want to convert Schrodinger's equation to convert this partial differential equation into a matrix. So here, of course, psi is a continuous function of position and time. And now we want to rewrite this. We're going to rewrite this now. H is no longer an operator. It's a matrix. So the subscript M there is just to tell you, to remind us that it's a matrix. And of course, psi now is a vector. And we're going to create a discrete approximation of this continuous function, simply by having a vector like so, right? And of course, we'll be able to define such a vector at any point in time. Now we're going to take the position as just being equally spaced. So n is an integer. And of course, A is the spacing between this. Now, of course, if I look at the derivative of a function f of x, then, you know, normally we would describe this as a limit and if we look at this as a limit that h goes to 0, we'd be happy that this was a reasonable description. So we're going to make an approximation, of course, of this, that we're going to have h being finite. And we'll, you know, hope that thing's very slowly enough that it's a good approximation. And we need the second derivative. And it's a nice long term. That's all there is to it, right? You know, finite difference method says, hey, approximate your derivative as its finite difference. And if you apply this twice, then what you end up with and while I get my signs right. Is a simple, it's an equally simple expression for the second derivative. Okay, so now then we say, fine. I want to know how to deal with H. And of course, remember that the operator H has two terms, this potential and the momentum term, if you like. And so now then we can replace the second derivative with the finite difference over there. And so I can do it here. And so we end up with the partial derivative Okay, so we know what to do with this term. Here, of course, all we're going to do is to take a discrete representation of the potential. So we'll define the potential at these points. And so we know what to do with the potential as well. And so we can rewrite Schrodinger's equation. In a simple form that says, I h bar d by dt psi sub n is equal to, so we just write it out for some eigenvector. I'm going to define something here for you. Let me define t sub 0 as h bar squared over 2 ma squared. Just shows up in every term. I get tired of writing it out. So we get this piece here. Okay, so we have Schrodinger's equation, but what I really want is, of course, I want this matrix. I want this operator. And so just to be brutal about the whole thing, we'll rewrite it to define that operator. Delta functions are, of course, Kronecker delta functions. And then we simply have psi sub n there. We're summing over m. And so now we can immediately say, this thing doesn't depend upon psi. So we can associate this piece with our matrix of the Hamiltonian. And it has an incredibly simple form. It says the potential appears on the diagonal, right? So we get the potential function on the diagonal. And these transport terms appear just above and below the diagonal. All right, so if you were solving for dynamics in the classical function, you would see exactly the same thing, right? That says, hey, the potential is going to tell us what's locally, what the energy is. And then the momentum term, which is basically this, tells us the ability to move through the system. Yeah? Okay. Having said all that, let's just go and have a quick look. So, you'll perhaps forgive me if I start with an infinite square well, but you know, let's just do something really bloody trivial, and then we'll be able to see how this all works, and then we'll look for something that's not quite so trivial. So, we define. Really, we do. We define the matrix. It'll come up here. There it is. And so we define the matrix, and you know, it has this bloody simple structure. And of course, since I'm looking at an infinite square well potential, then there's no potential function because the potential is zero. And you say, do I need to put the walls there? And of course, the answer is no. Right, by truncating the positions, I restrict the particle to being within there. So simply by truncating this, I remove the possibility that the particle can exit. And so that's as good as infinite square as infinite walls, as we'll see. We go ahead and look at the eigenvalues of that, and we see this nice eigenspectrum. And somewhere buried in your memory is that the eigenspectrum of a square well potential is parabolic. And so you see that here it's not bad. And then it doesn't get up to such to high enough energies. Why is that? Yeah, it says that we're making a lousy approximation of the wave function, right? We're integrating over the wave function to get those energies, essentially. So we can go ahead and look at this. One of the few times I bothered to get the numbers right. And you can see that this separation between the analytic and the approximation, not so bad. And of course, we can look at the wave functions. So these are the eigenvectors of that, things you've seen before. And of course, in this particular case, you know, it's trivial, right? The boundary conditions define the nodes, and the energy is just going to be dependent. It's a monotonic function of the number of nodes in the system. Okay. And a little bit more revealing is here I map out the analytic and the numeric solutions for the eigenfunctions. And so for the first eigenfunction, it looks pretty good. The second one, it looks pretty good. You know, these low energy ones, we really do make a pretty good estimate of these things. And eventually, we start to see that the finite sampling, as you suggested, shows up in terms of our representation of these. And so as we continue on, it's not surprising that the energy isn't a good approximation. I mean, it's not that the points, of course, that the points we sampled, you know, that they're correct. It's just that we're not interpolating in between them directly. And, you know, fine. In more complicated things, we could take care of that. But since we only care about the low energy states, why bother? Okay, so now let's put a sloped potential here. So in this case, I'm going to start by just looking at a sloped potential of the square well. So all I'm doing is taking the square well and adding a slope to it. Okay? So we look at the eigenspectrum again, and we see two things when we change the slope. One, we see that the low energy, the slope of the low energy eigenvalues changes, right? So it goes to something that looks much more like a linear function than a function that is a square. And you can see the other place that there's a lot of change is at the very highest energies, right? At the highest energy, instead of being flat, it picks up this linear piece. Yeah? So what's happening here? Let's talk about the low energy first. Why do we see a change in energy for the low energy states that changes the shape of the spectrum? It doesn't change the shape of the spectrum much over here. It's a little bit of a shift of energy, but that's okay, right? We are, in fact, shifting the energy by putting in a slope. So I don't care about the DC shift in energy. I care about the change. What's going on there?
The potential energy and the kinetic energy. So because the kinetic energy is low, then the potential energy, which is linear, it will compel and somehow.
So I agree with you. If I looked at the change of the shape of the wave function, what would it look like? Let's go look.
Changing?
We're changing the slope of the potential. So we have an infinite square well. And I'm putting on a potential, sloped potential over that. And this S is in fact the slope of this line. Yeah? So when S is zero, we return to the square well case. Okay, this is bad. I should set this up beforehand. I give away all of my secrets. All right. So let's go to about the fourth. It's a nice one. The fourth eigenstate for the square well potential. If I increase the slope here, how is this eigenfunction going to be changed? Right, we're going to calculate the eigenfunction of this sloped potential in a square well. Yeah.
The amplitude will increase on the left and decrease on the right.
Okay, I want you to say one more thing. So I agree with you, we're gonna have more amplitude over here. Maybe I want you to say two more things. Let me ask a question. Do the number of nodes change?
Probably not.
It's a good answer. Do the positions of the nodes change? Okay, I get one yes. You're right. So if we go and we change the slope, then we see that, as you say, things get packed up over there on the left-hand side. The number of nodes don't change, but their position gets compressed over there. So I take it you don't see this in your quantum mechanics course. Yeah, we'll even forget that you said that. So the whole point of having Mathematica is we very rarely have to learn special functions. And for those of us that suffered through it, believe me, that's a good thing. Okay, so now then we have these bits and pieces that we can calculate this. So we go back up and we say, we look at the energy spectrum and we see that the low end, we get this flattening. Your argument is good. The compression gives us that raise in energy. The reason that these things don't change their shape is? Yeah.
Quadratic grows faster than linear.
That's a theorist's answer. But that's a good answer. In terms of the wave function. These are at high enough energies that they don't see much of that slope off to the left, right? So these are pretty much spread over the whole well. And so the fact that we're doing something there doesn't have much of an effect. Why do we see this, you know, at the slope equals to zero, this thing is flat. And then we see that it becomes linear. Why is that?
Because of the integration, it doesn't increase quadratically. So then linear beats, well, whatever it is, like a constant there.
Yes, that's true. Here, the way I would say it is that we have these infinite walls, right? So that at this point, what we end up seeing is the effect of the infinite wall, not the effect of the slope. Okay, now, so now that we have a tool, we want to go back and apply that to the Josephson junction. So now we have a current. We're biasing this JJ. And remember that we calculated the current through this, and that it only took, it was fairly simple to do, that for the JJ, we can use Josephson's first rule that the current through this is dictated by the phase across the junction, right? And so this sets the amount of current that will flow through there. And of course, so we'll call that IJJ, this piece. And if this current is less than the critical current, right, this is just a parameter of the system, then this appears as a superconducting wire, and it shorts out the other two pieces. And then we have the resistance, which is going to, we'll calculate via Ohm's law, okay? And that's cool because we know that because there's a current through the JJ, Then we know what the voltage is, right? So that this is Josephson's first rule. His second rule is that the voltage is proportional to the change in flux, right? And so we can rewrite the voltage across this in terms of the change in flux. And of course, then we have a capacitor. So this is I of the capacitor and I of the resistor. And of course, the current through a capacitor is C times the derivative of the voltage. But we already know the voltage. So we get a second order equation from this, right? And so at the end of the day, what we ended up with is H bar C over 2E. So we ended up with a differential equation that looks like we're having a forced harmonic oscillator. And given this simple piece where we have a force over here, let me make say one more thing. Of course, the way we got this differential equation is we've defined all those currents. Now all we're doing is using Kirchhoff's law to add them up, right? And so with Kirchhoff's law, IDC is equal to I sub R plus I sub JJ plus I sub capacitor, right? And then immediately we get this. Now we want a Hamiltonian, and so we took this force and we described the potential as minus the derivative of the force. And so we end up with a potential U of phi, of course, that's equal to minus cosine phi minus IDC over IC times phi. So we have this washboard potential. And we saw a couple of nice things about the washboard potential. U of phi. And phi, when we take this ratio to zero, which we have control over, because we can set the DC current, right? That's a knob that we have control over. It's the only knob in this system. But we have that knob. So we can set that to zero. So we take IDC equal to zero. We have this periodic potential. And we ask, are there bound states in that periodic potential? Because, of course, if we have qubits, we would like to think that we would have a discrete number of bound states that we could use as a mapping of the qubits. Okay? And if we tilt that potential, then we'll have fewer bound states. And, of course, if we tilt it far enough so that IDC is equal to the critical current, then there are no bound states. And of course, if we were anywhere in this system, we would simply fall down this washboard potential. We fall down this washboard potential, we would change the phase. We change the phase, we would introduce a voltage. We could measure that voltage. And so the way we want to use the qubit So we'd like to say, here's two levels. These are my qubits. And then we'll do whatever our calculation is. I haven't told you how we get control yet. We'll do whatever our calculation is. And then at the end of the calculation, DiVincenzo says you should be able to measure something. And if we left, so if there was some probability that we were in this first excited state, then conceptually we could tilt the potential to the right place that the first excited state would tunnel through and fall down this washboard potential, and the bound state would remain bound. And so by looking at the voltage over the device, we would have some way of measuring the probability that we're in that first excited state. Yeah? Okay. So, sounds like a nice story. Why don't we see if it's true? So let's go and yes.
We should be able to do this like smoothly. Otherwise, the two wave packets just fail.
So at this point, I don't need to introduce a wave packet. Okay. Because I really do want to live in that space of the two spins, right? And so if I think about a wave packet, I think that I've spread the information out over many eigenstates, right? We're going to live in a superposition of two. And then there's a trick that says, hey, how do I know that I get a reliable measurement? But that's okay, because I'm going to assign that for homework. So.
Okay.
You'll get to see every last detail of it. But I agree with you, it's important. Okay, so let's go to a different simulation. So here, Here I just map out the potential as a function of the tilt. And notice, I've shifted it way up in energy, just because I don't want to have to deal with any bound states of negative energies. Okay? That's just for computational convenience. And of course, you know, we can feel free to add an independent potential anywhere we want. Okay, so here's the eigenspectrum as a function. Well, here's the eigenspectrum. It's as a function of IDC, of the tilt. But I've set the tilt to zero now, right? So we have this piece here, and we've set the tilt to zero. Now I'm doing this numerically. If I'm doing it numerically, then you need to remind yourself that when you're looking at this plot isn't showing you a piece of the potential, right? It's showing you the entire potential, and there's effectively infinite potential walls over it, right? Good. So now then, we go and look at the eigenspectra. Why are there degeneracies in the low energy eigenstates?
Isn't it that they can be in any of those levels?
So that's almost the case. I'd want it said a little bit differently than that. Because remember that now the IDC is zero, right? So the potential is a cosine that's not tilted. So you guys have studied band theory? What would band theory tell you about this?
Well,
What would the wave functions look like for this? Let's look at the wave functions, and then you'll have the answer. So with IDC equals zero, this is the first wave function. And then we'll just scan through there. The second, the third, the fourth, the fifth. And your answer that says it could be in any of them, the way I would have liked to hear it is that the shape of the wave function in each of those wells is the same, right? We can't differentiate between them. Now, of course, because we're in an infinite square well potential, go back to 2-1, we get this distortion of a parabolic shape because the lowest lying energy level of a square well potential has that same shape, right? So that gets superimposed on this. But that's a boring piece, right? And then we say, yes. And if this was infinitely of infinite extent, as that is of infinite extent, right? Then we would see that these would all be the same height and they would extend forever. Yeah? Good. Okay. And so then the degeneracy in energy simply says that we aren't, in fact, changing the shape of the wave function in any of those wells, right? The only thing we're changing is a trivial prefactor as we change the eigenstate over those. And so all we're going to see is the same energy, because the energy is going to be a combination of the potential function that this is sitting in, this cosine potential, and the shape of these pieces, which do not extend to the next, right? These are each, one could think of it as a wave function within a well that's been that is then being displaced. Do you have a question?
Yeah, I was wondering if these missing peaks are a function of there being nodes.
Those missing peaks are certainly, they're giving you the nodes. The nodes appear at all the nodes appear there, right? And so, the missing peaks are just to say what the simple symmetries, given five peaks, what symmetries can you have? Okay. So. You know, if I asked you to, it's a trivial problem. You know, if we had the infinite case, I'd say, we'll look at this five well piece. And you would give me a set of numeric basis states for those, right? You say, how many independent functions of 0 and 1 can I write in those? That's a little bit different because we've got this parabolic piece on top of there that we have to multiply by. But you know, that's a small computation. Small complication. Okay. So now we had five wells. So we get five states. What happens is I look at the sixth eigenstate. Remember that there was a five-fold degeneracy here. You can't see that, but you can take my word for it. That's a five-fold degeneracy. What happens as I go to the sixth eigenstate? Yeah, I'm going to put a node inside one of these wells, right? So, I hope so. Good thing. So now, in each of these wells, there's one node, right? Okay, so now we've got this piece that allows us to calculate the eigenstructure, but I'm not very happy with this particular one, right? Because what I really want is I want to work with two bound states. I don't want to work with an eigenstate that's spread out over all space, which is what this flat potential gives us. Right? So the first thing we want to do is to tilt the washboard so that there's actually a bound state in this problem. So we go up and do that. So I'm going to tilt the washboard. And you can see that the eigenspectra changes nicely. But, you know, it's more fun actually just to go back and look at what happens for an individual well. So there, we've tilted the washboard potential, tilting this way, so this is the lowest energy eigenstate, and you can trust me, it doesn't overlap with any of those things. So we can tilt the potential enough in this fictitious model where there's an infinite square well, right? That we get a bound state here. And then, of course, I get a bunch of other bound states. I don't care about those, right? They're at higher energies simply because of the potential is tilted. But the sixth one, I care about, right? Because now then this says, oh yes, I have an excited state in that well, which is also bound. Yeah, so now I have a qubit. I can work with those two energy levels. And the fact that there's a bunch of energy levels in between, that says we need to arrange the control sequence so we leave those alone. Yeah? And let me just say that. That's pretty easy, right? Because it says, hey, to go from here to here, I need to add a flux quanta. Or I should say to go from, you know, from here to here, I need to add a flux quanta to the system. And so it says, as long as you control the flux quanta in your system, then you'll be okay. Now, this should work so that every time I add 5, I go to the next one. So there's the bound state, the second excited state in that well. Still looks pretty good. There's the third one, and we start to have a problem, right? So the third excited state is in fact leaking out of the well. So right now what we have are three states under this particular potential that are nicely arranged, that are bound, and we could control those. Yeah? And, you know, just to continue one more, you know, as you go up, of course, things just get worse, right? I mean, that's no surprise, right? Go up, things get worse. Okay, so now then we have these bound states in the system. And we know how to calculate the eigenbasis for these things. Now I want to remind you of one more piece of trivial physics, and then we'll go over what I want you to do for a homework problem. Okay, so now then we've calculated the eigenstates, we can calculate the eigenstates for any tilt of the washboard potential. But of course, okay, we want to tilt the potential so that we have two states that we can work with. And then we want to be able to tilt it so that we can do the readout. We want to simulate that. And I just need to remind you of the time dependence of a state. So if I look at the time dependence of an eigenstate, it it evolves by a trivial phase factor, right? All things you knew and loved at some point. And let me just go and belabor the point a bit. So if I take a harmonic oscillator, and now we look at the eigenstates of a harmonic oscillator. Of course, we can define these are simple. And in addition to looking at the eigenstates, we can look at psi psi star and see the probability distribution as a function of the quantum number in just a purely harmonic oscillator. Just to show you some simple pieces. So now, if I take any eigenstate, and I look at the time evolution of that, all we see is some trivial phase moving around. Nothing interesting at all. But if, instead of looking at that, I looked at coherent superposition, right? If I look at a coherent superposition, now, of course, I end up with psi having two terms. These phases no longer are global phases, and we see the system evolving. And if instead of looking at the wave function, we would look at the probability, you know, things would look nice. It would sort of look like we really did have a harmonic oscillator, right? So trivial things to calculate, but necessary skills anyways. So here's what I want you to do. We don't need it anymore. I want you to look at what happens to an eigenstate as we tilt the potential. Okay? So you're going to start in an eigenstate of a given tilt. So this is your tilt. And that is, of course, the eigennumber. So you're going to start here. And I would like you to choose a bound state and to choose one that's local. In other words, one that's confined to one of the wells of the washboard potential. Okay? So clearly, alpha can't be 45 degrees. Good. Given this, go ahead and tilt it. So now then, alpha goes to alpha plus epsilon. So we tilt it. And now you have a new set of eigenstates. Right? Just as easy to calculate. And, of course, you can express this old eigenfunction in terms of the new one, right? Yes. So now then, yeah.
Are we doing it adiabatically?
No.
Are we doing it instantly?
You are going to make small discrete changes. By making small discrete changes, you can see the adiabatic limit. Okay? But remember that here, eventually you're going to get into trouble if you just think adiabatically, of course, because you're going to end up in this running piece. Okay? So we'll go ahead and calculate the new eigenstates. Given the new eigenstates, then we can express this as a sum over C sub k. Of course, you want to go the other way around, but that's okay, because you can calculate the overlap of those and extract the C sub k's, right? So you're going to determine these. And now exactly the time dependence that you expressed, right? So now then I have some new function. Let's just call it eta. And we're going to allow eta to evolve in time. So this is going to be the sum C sub k, psi sub k, alpha plus epsilon, e to the e sub k delta over h bar. And delta is the time it took. So effectively, you have one parameter in this, right? So that you're changing the slope. So the change in slope is equal to epsilon over delta, right? That's a time-dependent change in the slope. It's the rate that you're tilting this washboard potential. And you'll calculate this function. And I want you to calculate one more parameter, the voltage, as a function of time. Right? Because that's the parameter you have experimental access to. Okay, so go ahead, calculate this. Look at the voltage as a function of time. And what do you want to see? You want to see if the voltage jumps up. Right, as long as you have a bound state, the voltage isn't going to change. When you no longer have a bound state, the voltage is going to change. So see that you observe this jump in the voltage. Okay? And, of course, once you see the jump in the voltage, stop. And what would be good is to do this for two different initial eigenstates and show that the jump in voltage is separate for those two, right? And then you have a method of controlling reading out this superconducting system. Good. Okay, now, this is a piece of what we need. It still isn't the whole story, right? Because it says that we have this washboard potential which extends to infinity. And the fact that we can do this particular calculation is only given by the fact that they put an infinite square well here, right? So that I artificially define a set of nice bound states in this problem. So what we need to do this afternoon is to go and find a way to change the potential function up here so that we don't simply tilt it linearly, but that we can add a parabolic dependence to it. Because if I can add a parabolic dependence to it, then I no longer need to have those infinite well, right? There'll be one state which truly is at the lowest energy, and we can use that for our computation. Okay, so we'll show this afternoon how to make the circuit epsilon, just epsilon more complicated to add a parabolic dependence to the potential. Okay, good. So it's a little bit of programming. It's actually not that much if you use something nice like Mathematica or MATLAB. And good to get used to seeing these simple manipulations. So I'll see you at 2:00.